Welcome to you all the same, and to this important course on the judiciary and government, coordinated by Judge Dennis Davis and Michelle LaRue. Many of you, I know because I recognise you, have attended previous courses, but there are new people here. And the courses they have given have always focused on legal issues of significance in our country and on the challenges facing our democracy. In this course, they will consider the role of the judiciary and the pressure it is under from different sources, different constituencies and interests. The course will include two panel discussions on land reform and the Constitution and on freedom of information, and you will be introduced to those panelists in due course. I'm going to introduce both Judge Dennis Davis and Michelle LaRue, not at the same time, but one after the other, and then they will introduce the panelists later. You will know some of this information already. Judge Davis is a judge of the High Court and judge president of the Competition Appeals Court, a position he's held since 2000. He was a technical advisor to the Constitutional Assembly when the negotiations for SA's interim and final constitution were formulated, so he bears some responsibility, in fact. An honorary professor of law at UCT, where he teaches constitutional law, jurisprudence, competition and tax law, he's held many appointments abroad as a visiting professor, most recently at the prestigious Georgetown Law School and in Melbourne. Widely published in law journals, he's also written numerous books and is known to many of us as the feisty host of television current affairs programs. Michelle LaRue, who's giving the first lecture, is an advocate of the High Court of South Africa, a member of the Johannesburg Bar and a member of the New York State Bar. She practices as a trial lawyer for 8 years in New York City. I think that accounts for her blue shoes. She has appeared in trials, arbitrations, tribunal and other administrative hearings, and in proceedings at both intermediate and apex courts, and has particular interest in competition, commercial, constitutional, and public law. She shares, therefore, many of those interests with Dennis Davis, and they co-authored Precedent and Possibility, the Abuse of Law in South Africa, and I think they may be working on another book. Is that right? Yeah. Please welcome both of them, and then especially welcome Michelle to the first lecture. Thank you.
Good evening, and thank you for not only giving up 5 evenings in a row, hopefully, we will see you for all 5, but also for your continued support of the programs that Dennis and I have put on at summer school. I had a senior moment and thought this was my second appearance. Turns out it's my third. And when Ingrid asked us last year if we'd like to participate this year, we thought that was a smashing idea because the next book would be out and it would all be part of promoting the next book. That hasn't happened. And so hopefully by the time we get invited back, whenever that might be, we will in fact have a second book. But the conversation and dialogue that Dennis and I have been having over the last few years under commitment to Jonathan Ball Publishers to write about the judiciary has produced a lot of the material that we're going to be exploring this week. And so we were almost thinking of this week as a workshop of some of the ideas and themes that we'll be pursuing in the book. So you know, we certainly look forward to going through the week. The way we've structured it is I've got the theoretical conceptual beat tonight. So I'll be taking us through models of constitutional adjudication. Just to sort of get the framework of what it is we're talking about when we talk about the judiciary in a constitutional democracy. What is it that judges do? Why do we care about that? Dennis tomorrow will be doing the good, bad, and ugly. How are the courts doing? Where are they getting it right? Where are they getting it wrong? Where are they being perceived to be getting it wrong and coming under pressure? Then on Wednesday, we'll be looking at the issue of land. And obviously that is a fascinating issue when one looks at the role that has been given to law in order to effect that reform.
Can you speak a little louder?
Sure. Is that a bit better? And then on Thursday, we will turn to the question of information and the various aspects that that concept plays in our constitutional democracy. And that's everything from attempts to regulate the media and access to information, as well as the nature of information. Why is there anxiety around information? And that's national security questions, concerns now around the so-called secrecy bill, those type of issues. And then on Friday, Dennis and I will wrap up reflecting on the week, pulling together some of the themes, and then looking at the year ahead, where we know there are some high-profile cases coming that will be challenging to the judiciary. And we expect more of the sort of pressure and controversy to be placed on that institution in the coming year. I started by posing the question, why are we here? The course is called The Judiciary and Government. I like to think of it as the judiciary's role in governance, which is the process by which the South African state is trying to realize the constitutional democracy. It's trying to build that society which is set out in the blueprint, which is the Constitution. And judges have been given a very important role in that structure, which I'm going to take you through tonight. But we see a lot of anxiety around the role of judges and about the task that they've been given. So we see politicians, those in the other branches of government, the executive and the legislature, exhibiting an anxiety around what judges are up to. What are these judges doing? And so just from a smattering of press articles, if you Google, you know, counter-revolutionary, you get quite a few. But we have things like President Zuma saying, if I sit here and I look at a Chief Justice of the Constitutional Court, you know, that is the ultimate authority, which I think we need to look at it, because I don't think we should have people who are almost like God in a democracy. Why are they not human beings? He then went on to say, because you can have a judge of whatever level making a judgment, and other judges turning it over and saying it was wrong. This just tells you they're not necessarily close to God. And therefore, we have to look at it in a democratic setting. How do we avoid that? We have Nwankwo Ramaphosa, who's head of Parliament's Justice Committee, in 2009, making a statement talking about the same tension between the branches of government, saying, we must understand that none of us is above the law, regardless of the position we occupy, including the judicial officers. Just last week, we had Baden Zamandi warning on what he called a judicial dictatorship developing in this country. He said that the day the judiciary tries to substitute itself into the principle of the people shall govern, it runs the risk of losing the respect of the people. He went on to warn that where the legislature transgresses powers that it's given in terms of the Constitution, it cannot be beyond criticism. And then went on to describe the way judges criticize the judiciary, saying that it's tantamount to saying the judiciary cannot be subject to such criticism, and warned there can be no democratic order in some kind of country that's subject to judicial dictatorship. So these judges can't have the final word. We had Gwede Mantashe, who most famously referred to judges as counter-revolutionaries, saying earlier this year that every time there's legislation that passes through Parliament, there is a threat that it will be taken to court, and the court might position itself emotionally to reverse it. That's a problem. And then lastly, my Google search threw this up, which is a quote: if the court makes a fundamentally wrong decision, the president can in fact ignore it. Now you might wonder who that was. That was Newt Gingrich, Republican contender for the American presidency. He was discussing the Supreme Court decisions in the States giving rights to terrorism suspects and, you know, those who are incarcerated at Guantanamo and the like. And he committed himself to setting up a constitutional crisis on the first day he took office. if he was elected president, saying that saying that on the first day, he will issue an executive decision saying that they must ignore all of those court rulings, which means tortious fine, the habeas corpus right disappears, no standing in American courts. And when confronted with the fact that this would be a constitutional crisis, he said, I will issue an instruction on the opening day, the first day I'm sworn in. I will issue an executive order that it will not enforce Bombardier, which is the main terrorism rights decision, and it will regard it as null and void, because it's an absurd extension of the Supreme Court into the commander-in-chief's authority. So we're not alone in the tension between the different branches of government. And that's something that I want to turn to now, is how has the Constitution set up these different branches of government? We know that there are three branches of government, the judiciary, the legislature, and the executive. The executive makes policy and implements it, legislature passes the laws in parliament, and the judiciary is involved in holding these other branches accountable and checking that their output comports with the Constitution. So the Constitution is the foundation of our new South African society. It's the roots that give us the tree which branches into these different institutions, these different arms of government. And the founding provisions of the Constitution, Section 2, states that this Constitution is the supreme law of the Republic. Law or conduct inconsistent with it is invalid, and the obligations imposed by it must be fulfilled. It also, in Section 1, which establishes the Republic as one sovereign democratic state, founded on the values of dignity, equality, freedom, non-racialism, non-sexism, the third foundational value is supremacy of the Constitution and the rule of law. So what is this thing called the rule of law? We hear a lot about it. And what we would like to explore this week is the notion that the Constitution is just another piece of legislation. It's an act passed by Parliament and comes into force. But it's got a special name, the Constitution, because it constitutes, through law, the society that we're trying to live in. The institutions that are then given explicit powers and tasks in order to realize the vision of the society set out in the Constitution. So a brief look through the chapters in the Constitution explain that there's obviously Chapter 2, which is one of the most well-known sections, that's the Bill of Rights. It sets out everyone's rights and the duty on the state to progressively realize these rights. So we see for all the socioeconomic rights cases, some of which Dennis will be touching on tomorrow, where, for example, the right to water has been considered by the courts and by the Constitutional Court. What does that right mean? What must the government, the other arms of the state, be doing to progressively realize that right? But it essentially constitutes, it sets up the entire structure for government in South Africa. So it sets up the principle of what's called cooperative government, the need for the different levels of government, national, provincial, local, to work together in designated areas of expertise and functionality. It establishes provinces. It establishes the courts. It establishes our public administration, the state apparatus, the bureaucracy that is supposed to affect the policies. It recognizes the role of traditional leaders. It sets up the national flag and the national anthem. It sets out elections, which is the very core of our democracy. If we will have regular elections, there will be set terms of office, and how that process is undertaken. Obviously related to that is the right to vote and universal suffrage, which is another principle set out in here. And another critical aspect is that it sets up what are called the Chapter 9 institutions, which are state institutions whose task it is to strengthen constitutional democracy in the Republic. These are the Public Protector, the Human Rights Commission, the Commission for the Promotion and Protection of the Rights of Cultural, Religious, and Linguistic Communities, the Commission for Gender Equality, the Auditor General, and the Electoral Commission. So the Constitution sets up all of the entities, all of the institutions that are supposed to be pulling us forward into the type of society envisaged in the Constitution. Each one is given a particular task, a particular area of responsibility, and that includes the judiciary. It too is assigned a very particular role. In the separation of powers doctrine is the one that critically is framing these questions about whether the judiciary is overstepping its mark. So when politicians talk about judges are unelected and they're sort of coming into my turf and making policy, it's because there's a conception of separation of powers out there, and these politicians are sort of saying, this is our turf, you should be doing something else, don't come into our territory. In the certification judgment, which is the decision by the Constitutional Court certifying that the Constitution matches the principles that were committed to during the transitional negotiations, the court explains this notion of separation of powers as follows. It's the tritest version, checks and balances, that all power is accountable to another branch or another institution. So the court said that the principle of separation of powers, on the one hand, recognizes the functional independence of the branches of government, but on the other hand, the principle of checks and balances focuses on the desirability of ensuring that the constitutional order as a totality prevents the branches of government from usurping power from one another. In this sense, it anticipates the necessary and unavoidable intrusion of one branch on the terrain of another. No constitutional scheme can reflect a complete separation of powers. The scheme is always one of partial separation. In Justice Frankfurter's words, the areas are partly interacting, not wholly disjointed. The court went on to say, about our specific conception of separation of powers, that the model adopted reflects the historical circumstances of our constitutional development. We find in the Constitution checks and balances that evidence a concern for both the over-concentration of power and the requirement of an energetic and effective, yet answerable, executive. So these are the type of concerns and issues that separation of powers is trying to balance. And courts are given the role of being the adjudicators in this framework. We all have heard the courts referred to as the weakest arm of government. It's been said that they lack power because they have no power over either the sword or the purse. They don't have powers of physical coercion or compulsion. And while their decisions may have budgetary consequences, they themselves can't assign resources to a particular task. So their legitimacy and integrity, the commitment to follow their decisions, is what gives you an effective judiciary and adjudicative system. So courts themselves are bound by this doctrine of separation of powers. They can only do so much. And the other thing that constrains judges is obviously they can only adjudicate on the litigation before them. Obviously, there is the notion of a confirmation of constitutional invalidity. So if a litigant comes to a lower court, challenges a piece of legislation, that judge finds that it is constitutionally invalid, that must be automatically confirmed by the Constitutional Court. But other than that, litigation is always framed by who you've got in front of you. And how far a court is prepared to go, and what a court can actually order, is obviously constrained by who's in front of you and what they're asking for. So for example, in the DA's review of the dropping of charges against President Zuma, you'll recall the acting head of the NPA, Mokhtedi Mshe, dropped charges. The DA reviewed that decision. The lower court dismissed that application, saying the DA didn't have standing. The DA didn't have an interest to come and challenge that. Now, that case is one of the ones which I think we'll be discussing on Friday. It's coming up in front of the Supreme Court of Appeal this term. But judges use concepts like standing to, and they're constrained by things like that to, in order to deal with the litigation in front of them. Now, what's unique, one of the innovations South Africa has made is that we've expanded standing. So things like class actions, things like you could bring something to the courts if it's in the public interest. So it might not directly affect me and my rights, but if I'm acting in the public interest by bringing that litigation, the courts will entertain it. So if we think of Glenister or Terry Crawford Brown, these are individuals who've gone through lengthy, lonely, costly years of litigation because they are convinced that it's in the public interest that these rights be vindicated. Which brings us back to another concept for those of you who are frequent flyers in the Davis and LaRue Summer School program, this notion from John and Jean Komaroff of lawfare, which is the notion that where politics, understood as sort of, obviously we think education is political, but politics in that sense of, you know, elections and marches in the street and being able to influence the decisions in parliament and the actions taken by one's executive, where politics is somehow not delivering the political and social destination, the goals that a particular person or group wishes to see delivered, there's a resort to courts. So rather than what they call warfare, which is the traditional power play, which is politics, if you get enough votes, you get your guy in office, and it's usually a guy, and you know, you can pursue a particular agenda. Where that's not working, where politics somehow isn't delivering the results, there's a resort to courts. And these political battles get displaced into the courts in what the Komaroffs have termed lawfare. But obviously that is where you get a lot of controversy, and you get the other branches of government criticizing the courts for playing that role. So whatever the division between lawfare and warfare, there's always going to be a political controversy that arises, and it's navigating this which is the thing that's putting the judiciary under pressure at the moment. Because adjudication is essentially concerned with an allocation of rights and duties. It's allocating responsibilities, power, resources. And unfortunately, we don't have time to go into a lot of the theories around that. But there, if you think of there being sort of different goods in a society, the courts are now involved in distributing and allocating. So Rawls has explained these goods, these legal goods, as being, so the legal goods are equal and non-discriminatory treatment of all people. Political goods is participation in the political process, and freedom of speech and association. Material goods, we understand that, a contract, fight, a property dispute, those are material goods. And then self-respect, or in South African legal parlance, the notion of dignity, and that is the opportunity for every individual to lead a satisfying and worthy life. So judges, when they're adjudicating in these different arenas, are concerned with contributions to political and social change, bringing these benefits to people formerly deprived of them. And obviously, there are a lot of different ways in which a court could entertain this type of litigation. There are a lot of different approaches that are available to judges. And Catherine Young has produced a model of what this looks like. So it's a bit less of a physics experiment than it looks like. So to start off here, we've got what she calls a deferential court. This is the court that defers to the other branches of government. It steps out of making the ultimate decision and says, you know what, that's for Parliament, or it's for the executive to decide. So for example, when the Constitutional Court deferred to the executive and said, I'm not going to release the Kampepe report. You'll recall Justices Kampepe and Mosoneke went to Zimbabwe during the elections to look at whether the process was free and fair. A challenge was brought to release that report. The court said, will accept the say-so that it would be politically complicated, that it may harm the diplomatic relations of the Republic if we got involved in this. So we'll defer to the other branches. Then you have what she calls conversational adjudication, which is where litigants come to the court, and the court then facilitates a dialogue to try to resolve the dispute. So we see that sort of approach in South Africa, where the Constitutional Court has had these applications from illegal occupiers. So a landlord wants to evict illegal occupiers of a building. A lot of them have been in the CBD of Johannesburg. And the courts have wrestled with what one does with this problem. And we'll get into this as well tomorrow in the land lecture. But you know, traditionally there would be the notion that I'm the landlord, it's my property, you're an illegal occupier, you're a trespasser, I can evict you. And the court has said, can't we all work together? Can't we consult and engage and try to find out if there's alternative accommodation? Find out what the occupiers require, what do they actually need? And try to facilitate with the municipality the achievement of that type of life for those occupiers. So the court is facilitating a conversation between the parties trying to resolve it. Then we have what she calls an experimentalist court, where the court steps back and sends them off to try to resolve things. So it chooses not to resolve, not to suggest a solution or really get involved in the nitty-gritty, but it says, you go off, you're the experts, you've got the interests, you go and try to settle and come back to me. Then you have managerial courts. And for the lawyers in the room, that's where you would get something like a structural interdict remedy. So courts will exercise an oversight role on an ongoing basis. So we see, for example, in the death penalty cases, we had the Makonyane decision, which prohibited the death penalty. Thereafter, the Constitutional Court was engaged in a process where reports were filed about the number of death row inmates, what had happened to their, they were being evaluated to see whether, what should happen to their sentencing. And it was an ongoing process where the court kept calling for reports, would send back questions. It was managing the process. There was oversight as to what would happen to all of these death penalty judgments, the original sentence. And then that, of course, is what she would call a peremptory decision, which is the court outlawing the death penalty. From today onwards, there will be no more death penalty. So she then describes that type of court as a supremacist court, a court that's more engaged in this conversation resolution of the dispute, and then a court that she refers to as quite detached. Because obviously what underpins the role of the courts always is their dispute resolution agents. So we should never forget that the overwhelming majority of litigation in this country, the courts see, never makes it to the front page of the newspapers, never makes it into the law reports. It's people getting divorced. It's criminal cases. It's those type of disputes, neighbor disputes, contract fights. It's people resorting to the courts in order to resolve their disputes. And Young decides, having analyzed what our constitutional court has done, she decides that our constitutional court is what she terms a catalytic court. So it's a catalyst to assigning political energy. It decides, in a given case, which is the best approach to take. So it's not wedded to just one approach. It's always peremptory, or it's always detached and deferential. It determines in each case what it wants to do. And through the course of the week, we'll see how courts are choosing between these different models. Now, this obviously comes from one academic. There are obviously libraries full of doctorates and professorships are built on theorizing adjudication and constitutional adjudication. So, for example, Rosenberg refers to dynamic and constrained courts. He sees it as a lot more binary in terms of what a court can do to effect social and political reform. And then Tienus Roux, who's a South African academic, has also analyzed the South African court. And he sees our constitutional court navigating its way through three poles, three concerns. The first is legal legitimacy. So the legal reasoning used by a court, do other lawyers accept it? Do we buy into the logic? Is it following the system of precedent? You know, where a prior decision binds it, is it following that faithfully? Or where it departs from it, are its reasons distinguishing the earlier decision? Is that justifiable? Do we accept that? That's one poll. Related to that is the question of institutional independence, which is we always hear about it, the independent judiciary, an autonomous court system. And that means it's free from interference, it's free from influence. And obviously, if it's legitimate in its reasoning and in its output, it will feel more robust and confident and assert itself more strongly. And then that's related to the third poll, which identifies public support. And you can see how, if there's legitimacy in decision-making, the institution will have public support. And what I often think is missing in all of the attacks on the judiciary that we see is that public support. You know, whether it's from the profession, the bar, and the law society, or whether it's civil society speaking up, commentators, where there's public support, it's a lot easier to have an independent judiciary standing up to interference and influence. And where you have a court that is legitimate in its reasoning and in its decision-making, the public will recognize that it's competent, doing a good job, and therefore support it, and stand up against other branches of government that may be trying to attack it. So all of this, of course, we talk about this thing, the judiciary, but it's people. It's men and women who have been appointed by the Judicial Services Commission to do this task. They're assigned this role, but they are, contrary to President Zuma's first quote, they are just human beings. And this is where we get the issue around judicial appointment and the transformation of the judiciary. And we get these statements about a judicial mindset and what the appropriate mindset is. And unfortunately, that has sometimes collapsed into identity essentialism. So my gender, my race, my struggle credentials will stand as surrogates for whether I have a commitment to constitutional values. But there's what's also going on there is it highlights that there's an individual choice made by judges in terms of how they approach a given case, how they're going to adjudicate. And we see this most starkly in the two different approaches that were taken to the Zuma criminal charges. So you'll recall Judge Nicholson took one view of his role and he went quite far in his judgment calling for Commission of Inquiry and really talking about the political interference that had gone on in the charging of Zuma and really engaged with the sort of conspiracy theory that was put to him in the papers. It then went on appeal to the Supreme Court of Appeal in Bloemfontein, where Judge Harris wrote the decision, which was blistering in its attack on Nicholson's approach. And Harris said the following about the judicial function. He said, in the judgment, it is crucial to provide an exposition of the functions of a judicial officer because, for reasons that are impossible to fathom, the court below failed to adhere to some basic tenets, in particular that in exercising the judicial function, judges are themselves constrained by the law. This is when I would start typing my resignation letter if I was Judge Nicholson. The underlying theme of the court's judgment was that the judiciary is independent, that judges are no respecters of persons, and that they stand between the subject and any attempted encroachments on liberties by the executive. This commendable approach was unfortunately subverted by a failure to confine the judgment to the issues before the court, by deciding matters that were not germane or relevant, by creating new factual issues, by making gratuitous findings against persons who are not called upon to defend themselves, by failing to distinguish between allegation, fact, and suspicion, and by transgressing the proper boundaries between judicial, executive, and legislative functions. He went on to write, Judges as members of civil society are entitled to hold views about issues of the day, and they may express their views, provided they do not compromise their judicial office. But they are not entitled to inject their personal views into judgments or express their political preferences. Now, I don't know how one could adjudicate cases in a constitutional democracy without having a personal philosophy and personal politics about what our society should look like. There's a movie out at the moment, The Eyes of March, with George Clooney, where he talks about how he's an atheist, essentially, but his religion is the Constitution. That's what he believes in. And in a sense, when we talk about mindset and judicial mindset, that's what we're looking for. We're looking for a commitment to constitutional values at a personal level, that you take this job because you want to take on that task. You want to move the society forward to that envisaged in the Constitution. And Harris concluded the section of the judgment by saying, the independence of the judiciary depends on the judiciary's respect for the limits of its powers. Even if, in the words of the learned judge, the judiciary forms a secular priesthood, this does not mean that it is entitled to pontificate or be judgmental, especially about those who have not been called upon to defend themselves. As said, its function is to adjudicate the issues between the parties to the litigation and not extraneous issues. Now, of course, what's fascinating about Judge Harris's apolitical approach, judges are not political, they shouldn't be injecting their political views, they shouldn't express a political preference, is itself a political act, is itself a political choice that Harris is making. He doesn't want to get into those issues, so he's describing what judges do as in an apolitical way. Of course, the example he started off with when he was criticizing Nicholson for straying into all these things that a judge, a proper judge, wouldn't get into, was the issue of an appointment to the Commission of Inquiry into the Armsdale. And you'll recall, we'll get to the quote, but Harris writes, the court found, quite rightly, that it was beyond its competence to make such an order, to appoint a commission of inquiry, where that hadn't been asked for by the litigants before it. But it then proceeded to add at length that a commission of inquiry into the arms deal, which gave rise to some of the criminal allegations against Mr. Zuma, should be appointed, quote, to rid our land of this cancer that is devouring the body politic, close quote. Whether or not one agrees with these sentiments is beside the point. The point is that those personal sentiments concerning a political decision were, in the context of a judgment, unwarranted. Now, of course, we know that President Zuma did not appoint a commission of inquiry thanks to the musings of Judge Nicholson as to how he could resolve his political problems. But we do know that President Zuma has appointed a commission of inquiry into the arms deal precisely because he wanted to avoid filing his answering affidavit in the Constitutional Court in Terry Crawford Brown's application for precisely that relief. So we can see how litigation is being used and judges choose their moments, but it's ultimately a political act because what adjudication is doing is helping us realize the constitutional democracy prefigured and envisaged by the Constitution. Thank you very much. So I don't know if anyone has any questions or comments or anything. Yes.
Much in our media, there's quite a constitutional crisis going on in Hungary at the moment, which you probably looked about, where essentially, much the same as here, the government is trying to chip away at the constitutional court's authority.
Yeah.
Are there any other countries that
isn't there? Well, in Swaziland, much closer to home, the monarch has appointed a chief justice that nobody likes, and they've completely privatized the legal system. So the loyalist judges show up to work, but there's no one to just get in front of them. The Law Society and the Bar have essentially organized their own courts. So it's now sitting essentially as an arbitration in a boardroom, you know, of a law firm. They've complete, and all disputes, the judges that people think are the judges that have some legitimacy of participating in the process, they just completely disengage themselves from the Chief Justice. We've had, where is the judge? Who's an investigative judge. Their system's slightly different, but they have judges who are sort of investigators as well. He's a very high-profile judge who's coming under pressure. He's now being, he's got, I think, three trials, starting 1 week after another, various criminal charges. So, you know, other than drunk driving, we haven't charged our judgment with anything yet, but, yeah, I mean, any society where you have the separation of powers, there's this tension. There's, you know, and because the main criticism that comes is judges are unelected. I went to the ballot box, I marked, I got parliament and the executive that I voted for, didn't vote for, my representatives are in parliament, or they're somewhere. And judges appointed by the split of the JSC all comes out of a, you know, a cartel, a bar, a sidebar, and all comes out of this secret society, huge barriers to entry. We don't know these people. You know, they're unelected and appointed. But Sydney Kentridge, who's probably one of the finest advocates this country has produced, and he was an acting judge on our constitutional court as well. I was at a bar council dinner in Johannesburg where he was honored. And in his speech, he dealt with this problem, this notion that there's a democracy deficit around judges. And he said, he doesn't see why there's a problem, because democracy in South Africa comes through the Constitution and sets up a system. So anything done in accordance with the constitutional scheme, anything done in the appropriate way, would have legitimacy in terms of democracy and in terms of the Constitution. So where the JSC is properly constituted and has considered candidates, recommended them to the president who has appointed them, that person, that judge, then has all of the democratic legitimacy because the process was followed. So it's a different process, but it, you know, it gives legitimacy to those appointments.
Yeah, there's been talk in the paper of the assessment of the functioning of the Constitutional Court by the state. I imagine they won't have that model in mind, but do you have any idea of what criteria they're looking for?
There hasn't been further detail given. So, I mean, frankly, if it's like properly, an assessment of the work of the judiciary would show that it's actually gone quite far and done quite a lot, possibly more than the other branches of the government, to realise some of the rights and you know, some of the promise that's in the Constitution. Yes, there have been some mistakes, but on the whole, its record, I think, is worthy of praise, not criticism. So we're not, you know, we still don't know what the assessment looks like, what the criteria are. And I think the outcry that followed that cabinet announcement, I mean, it's buried in the cabinet briefing. I mean, I've pointed it out, there's pages and pages on all sorts of things that you don't care about. And there's this little paragraph which says, you know, an assessment of the judiciary's role in the developmental state. And we don't really know what that means, and there hasn't been much follow-up in terms of actually saying what is the institution that's going to do this, what are the criteria. And you can imagine that as soon as that gets set up, you know, civil society and hopefully and the profession, everyone will, you know, participate fully in that process. But we don't, you know, at present we don't yet know. And of course the concern is you don't just do an assessment for the sake of doing an assessment. Will it impact allocation of resources? Will it impact other things? What are you going to do if you don't apply? If the assessment comes up negative, what are the consequences of that? So it's all
of it. I accept the thesis that judges must, in addition to interpreting the Constitution, they too are bound by the Constitution. But this question that crops up in my mind is how do we ensure that the judges do not become the overlords of the Constitution?
Yeah. Those of you in the back, The proposition is that judges too are bound by the Constitution, that they themselves must be bound by the Constitution. But it's essentially who's guarding the who's guarding the guardhouse, who's watching the judges. There are things like, you report misconduct to the Judicial Services Commission, but they haven't worked out what misconduct means yet. They haven't set up, there's a draft guide of, what's it called, the guide of conduct, judicial conduct somewhere, for what judges should be doing, for disclosing financial interests so that you don't have conflict of interest cases, setting out what would be misconduct, but that hasn't come into force, it hasn't been decided. So we don't have something to measure them against, or a mechanism to measure them against, and at the moment, impeachment is an incredibly high standard, so you can't censure, the difficulty is censuring a judge without full-on impeachment. We don't have those mechanisms yet, so we know we need them. But they're sitting in draft form, they're not currently, they're not in the process. But the other thing, of course, is that the appointment process should be far more rigorous than it is. A lot of the commentators you would have seen when the controversy erupted about McQueen's elevation to Chief Justice, that all these judgments came out revealing questions about his commitment to constitutional values, particularly gender equality and the like. And a legitimate response was, where were you when he was first made a judge? A positive result of that, speaking from the bar side, is that there's now a process. So in all these new rounds of judicial appointments, the bars have got together and divided up the candidates, and there's now a much more rigorous examination of all their previous judgments and decisions in order to determine this commitment to constitutional values, so that we have a much better sense of candidates. But it's, there's a lot still to be done, and we know there's a problem, and we haven't enacted a lot of it. Yes.
You mentioned the value of public support for the judiciary. And I'm struggling a little bit with that. I can think of lots of examples where public disapproval of judiciary happens around the world. Do you have any good examples where the public has come out strongly in favor of the judiciary?
Spain?
I think it's much more the question of where the judiciary makes a decision and the public generally approves that.
It's not very vocal usually. They say,
No. I think it's more important than that. I think that if you get a decision on the judiciary, there's a complication. Take the death penalty, where I suspect the public doesn't like it. But the government, the ANC to its great credit under Mr. Mandela, certainly did not want the death penalty. And I think the previous, of course, they mentioned the extraordinary situation that Mr. Mandela inaugurated the Constitutional Court, which was the day before there were any other case. He said, the last time I was in the court was to hear whether I was going to get the death sentence. It was probably the biggest hint that you could ever have to the judiciary that it's such a bad idea to have the death sentence. But the proposition of that is there that the public don't like, but the government did. But if the government doesn't like something, and generally speaking, the courts, the public are in favor. So let me give you an example. Let us postulate for the purposes of debate that the secrecy bill winds itself up into Parliament. And at the end of the day, the courts find against the secrecy bill, much to the anger of the government. I would not suggest to you that it's unlikely that very much would happen to the courts, other than more hot air. But if the public, on the other hand, thought the secrecy law was a splendid idea, I suspect the court would be under some trouble. That's, I think, the best example I can give you.
But also, if you think about the treatment action campaign, it was very savvy litigation. It goes back to what my union clients call the point of default. It goes back to the earlier point that you have litigants in front of you, and they've crisped up the issue that you need to decide. So in doing the first one, we interviewed the legal teams, and they said, absolutely spot on. Their strategy was to pick the most sympathetic avenue to attack the and in fact refers to that as judgment, knows what's going on outside. The gay rights cases, probably, you know, when we see some of the corrective rape cases and things that are unfortunately happening, you know, we live in a homophobic country. But very savvy litigation that very incrementally built up gay rights. So recognize same-sex partners for pension benefits, recognize same-sex partners for adoption, recognize same-sex partners, you know, for all those type of sort of smaller things, and then they went for marriage. And the court similarly went very softly, probably knowing that, you know, there wasn't going to be a whole lot of public support for something very, very stark. I mean, something that I think is going to come up, and it's, you know, it's going to be one of the tests that comes up this year, is this top TV pornographic channel debate. So for the first time, ICASA is exercising its right to have public hearings before it approves a broadcast. It hasn't really done it. No one cares about another Super Sport channel. But we're going to have public hearings on whether South Africa should have pornography. Concern, of course, is who's going to show up and say, you know, it's called the adult channel because we're adults, and if it's properly controlled, we should do that. So, you know, the court's going to have to navigate some of these type of issues, and we're going to see them trying to work their way through it. I mean, sex workers' cases, they've been, I think, been horribly conservative, rather than extending protection to sex workers. Any other questions? Yes, at the back.
To revert to the arms deal.
Yes.
Would it be legally possible for the president to dismiss or disband the appointed commission? Who's effectively investigating the arms deal as soon as the protection of information law, if and when, becomes law?
I feel like I'm in a law exam. The fact pattern gets more complicated. In terms of reference, anything we have to have? Terms of reference? The secrecy rule is about classification of information, access to information. So, as I said, the interface would be whether at the hearings, public can be there, media can be there, on the ultimate report, are there lots of pages that are just black marking, you know, black poker pen, and we don't actually get the answers because they're all being classified.
But could he disband or dismiss the commission as soon as...
The commission couldn't be disbanded for that. And if you disbanded the commission, you wouldn't learn that. I'm trying to work out.
Arbitrary, actually.
Well, if you suddenly woke up one morning and said, I don't know why I did it in the first place, and I'm now going to disband it. Goodbye to the three judges. One, I'm not quite sure what you're
stop the process because Justice Erasmus was already in the process
And I mean, the state of legal reporting in this country is so diabolical. I mean, cases that I'm in, I get phone calls. Oh, you said that, am I? Yeah, well, that's what the newspaper said, really. You know, so there's a, where are the public getting their information? If it's, you know, legal commentators, we've all got a view, we've all got an agenda, so. I mean, there have been surveys done which measure public confidence in the judiciary, and it is abysmally low. It's sort of equal to the elected branches of government. And it's not clear, I mean, the interpretation of some of that is that it's just sort of a lack of understanding of what judges do. So the assumption is they're like everybody else. So I think that, I mean, there's an enormous need for education about adjudication, what judges do, how they do it, what they're up to, you know, that there isn't this hysterical kind of discourse that we sort of have attack on the judiciary, or, you know, they're in a bunker defending themselves. That, you know, we need to have a bit more of a nuanced understanding about what judges do. And I think that, you know, there's been a mystification which gave power to the role. You know, so it was sort of this decree that comes down, and it's because that person is seized of some enormous expertise and whatever. And the comrades have written about this. You know, the notion that judges are experts in everything. So a judge knows what's in the best interest of children, even if they themselves are a terrible parent, or, you know, divorces or the like. You know, we put judges into a role to be experts where, you know, perhaps they don't have that expertise, and people might have bad experiences with judges. Now, I'm conscious that it is 9 o'clock, which is termination time. So I don't know if we can take one more question, and then, you know, if there are people who'd like to stay and keep discussing, we can do that, and everyone else who's waiting, sitting in the mic, and their fans and whoever you can
depart. Just an observation.
Yes.
I don't know how legal profession feels about it. There's a very good block on constitutional law put out by UCT academic
Charles Cross.
And it might be good reading.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we've got quite a few commentators that are doing a good job at educating. I think the profession has been too reticent to do that. I think we should, you know, we sit in our common rooms and agonize over issues, and I think we could be getting out there putting ourselves in public saying that, which is why.
I'd like to make one comment about that. Because under apartheid, I want to put it to you that I think there was far more active critique than there is today from the legal academic community. Let me give you, those some of you who are my age and beyond will know that there were people like John Dugard and Bart Fenikic and Tony Matthews and a whole range of academics, my dear lecturer Tessian Uranic, people who wrote continuously and really brilliant in the newspapers on a regular basis. I always say to the newspaper editors when they complain that they've got, you know, they have the money for legal correspondence. Why don't you get some of the academics to answer this, because some of them aren't coming forward? But I do think it's shameful that under apartheid, at the worst of times, people wrote continuously. I mean, I remember myself writing 10, 12, 15 columns with my dear late friend Gerald Gordon in the 1980s about the emergency. And the answer was because you wanted to expose what was going on. And I think what the force of God is tremendous is far too little of that happening. And it's an important component that we forget about, because it is the public discourse. And might I say, my prayer is that it will be a public discourse that reflects the demography of our country, so that in fact we'll have from all quarters of the legal community and beyond the kind of critique which we need to have. And I think it's shameful that we're not, you know, you can mention